Hey guys, this is Reese Alley with the Built with Purpose podcast. Today we have Ryan Bailey on here. And keep in mind, this is a podcast where we talk about careers, life, business, what it takes to succeed, and the trials and tribulations along the way. But, Ryan,
exciting to be here.
Yeah, we'll work on the intros. But so obviously, you work for us right now. You've got several adventures on the sides. You're an outdoorsman, you build software, and have played a absolutely crucial role into our business as a whole. But today I want to talk about just where it started from the beginning. You know, you're part in our business, what you're doing on the side, and you know, really what the bigger picture looks like for you, specifically on the software side, as that has tremendously benefited us as a company so far. This, you know, being on the outer edge of that. But can you just explain just from the very beginning, you know, one, what got you started in construction? You know, at least this industry, there's a lot of people running away from it. There's a lot of people that don't want anything to do with it. But why did you get involved? Why did you not run away like everybody else?
Yeah. So, I've had a job, and I find it funny. You know, I've had a job since I was about 11 years old. I've cut grass. I've done handyman. In that time frame of being very young and moldable, I was coming out of, you know, we had sold our family farm. I knew dairy farming. That was kind of the only thing I knew. I knew hard work. We knew the long, hot days in summer, just throwing swear bales. And I realized very quickly that that was not going to be the life that I wanted to live. I saw what the environment was around me. And I knew that construction was just, there was always something cool going on, to say the least. Anything about construction, building things, you know, seeing things go up, the equipment, it just had this really great appeal to it. And as I was in handyman and little odds and end jobs, I got to where I was able to go to a trade school and learn masonry, brick, block, and stone. I went through a 3-year program there, and I started working with a masonry company. I started working with a couple of different carpenter outfits and just really getting hands-on. That was the easiest way to get into the trade, was just go out and learn with your hands. From there, I went and got to a point where I saw there was a bigger opportunity. There was something more out there, and I decided to go to college. So I went to college for a bachelor's degree in construction management. Still, you know, loved every bit of construction. I got to see some technology, got to see some new ways of doing things. But going to college for me really led to seeing how large companies operate. I was no longer working with, you know, for all intents and purposes, the handyman homer guy. Like just fixing things. We were actually building big things. We had lots of people. We had newer equipment. We had, you know, access to being able to buy material and have it all out in front of you. So there was this full eye-opening experience of just seeing the value of getting on a new construction project and seeing it start from the ground all the way till the time that it was finished and handed off to the customer. That last year in college, I was able to take a job with a very large company. And that was really the big turning point of where we were playing a whole entire different game. It was more people, it was more equipment, it was more materials, it was bigger problems, but it gave a really good position to be in to find a problem and solve the problem. It was no longer how hard do you work determines your pay, it's what kind of problems can you solve.
And I think to stop you a little bit on that, because that's now getting into what the question I was about to ask. So that company is called Kiewit. But in that position, how many people did you directly manage at your heights? Just to set some context around.
So early on, like my first couple months to about a year, I was in charge of 4 to 6 people. We were in a civil estimating division. We were switching from transmission and power to renewable energy. So it's like, this is an entirely new market. We have no idea what we're doing, but you're in charge of them.
Jobs of what value range?
I mean, we bid everything from small jobs being $300,000 to $400,000 site work packages, large scale $20 to $50 million site work packages, depending on some of the complexities there. Overall global scope of some of these projects, everything from 500 to 1.3 billion, I think, was the largest project we were on. So at that point, early on, I was only directly responsible for, say, 4 to 6 people. Shortly within the next 2 years, I was responsible for 10 to 15 and then upwards of 65 people by the time I was about ready to leave.
And the transition from, you know, 4 people, 15, and then 65, the 65 was more operations, right? That we were physically installing things and building things, whereas the initial team was strictly estimating and putting the projects together.
That's right. And we were very micro grouped. So it was a very specific division, and we had parts and pieces spread out amongst a team of 4 people. So there was likelihood that two of us were working on 2 different projects, but they were very similar in scope. And when we got to the larger side of that, we were just installing one portion of work. At that time, we were installing posts for a solar racking assembly.
And to add further context to this, for those that don't know who Qt is or what they are, if you're in the construction industry, you probably do. They're a multi-billion dollar company. And they have a book that is an autobiography, I guess, written by the founder, by, you know, the ownership, that's only distributed to employees. It's like $1,000 to buy on Amazon. But I read it just because Ryan had a copy. And this is very intriguing because I think a lot of us that are trying to grow businesses and I can, you know, go through the ranks and figure out what to do. There are stories of the founder of this company, and I think this trickles down into the question I'm about to ask about that. But where, and this is like the early 1900s, he goes from a company that's relatively, you know, small to what they are now, $30, $40 million. And they're getting these massive government contracts where he's staffing, what was it like?
It was in the,
like 120,000 employees over the course of a few months at a time. It was absolutely insane. And you talk about, I mean, we're sitting at like 20 employees right now. We've been, you know, churning through some people, trying to find the best ones. But this guy staffed 120,000 people in a 3-month period to fulfill one contract. And this is in the early 1900s where there was no phones, there was no anything. It was a guy that had a vision and a job to go do. And so I asked that question to say, as you've been a really big part of the systems that we've built and helping us create something that makes sense for everybody, both on the software side and also just on the operation side, what did you learn there that, you know, it's not the early 1900s, they've come a long way since, but what's some things that are simple in nature, but a lot of companies get wrong that they really, really got right that made a big impact on you?
Yeah. With people all over the place, whether it be 4 people, 15 people, or 65 people, organizational structure, who reports to who and who's responsible for doing what, and then the second piece is the process in which we're doing it. So as we reviewed this morning in an internal company meeting, we say a org chart, and to some that means, you know, we have all different organizational structure, and I report to you, and you report to so-and-so, and we're going to just go up the ladder if we have problems, but in reality, it's you are in this position to handle this set of process. And it's not necessarily pay-based, it's not necessarily responsibility-based, but it is a I want to say, almost perfect fit for what you're capable of doing. So in a position, if you have a process, it is these steps that are more than likely right and have proven to be successful and are good patterns to repeat versus all of the things that you're not supposed to be doing. You don't want to duplicate those because it's just going to lead to headaches. So those two things, I think in particular, in relation to everything we do in life, I think are absolutely crucial. And that would be setting clear expectations about the role, you know, monitoring that role and position to make sure that we're not doing extra steps and we're not repeating work or repeating the wrong decisions. And then accountability to it to make sure that the person himself is accountable to staying within the role, the procedure, as well as it is somebody above him to check in and keep on track. It's always a team effort. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have a boss and a worker, but in reality, it's a team. It's multiple people working together where they're good at to make a problem go away.
So that all makes sense, but you get a little bit more on the personal side with Qt. You know, this is a massive company, had 65 direct reports, very large operation, specifically the pile driving. I don't know if you mentioned that, at least on the back end. But what were some of the most memorable stories from Qt? It could be, you know, you mentioned this, the huge tracks, the truck that got stuck. But is there anything that sticks out in your mind as just a funny, memorable thing that happened there where, you know, you don't assume stuff like happens like that at a big company, but it does, and everybody's just got to turn around and laugh about it in the end?
Being a large company, we go to these district meetings and we talk about doing things the best. We talk about the best performance. We talk about the best rates, the production factors, the time in versus time out and return. I think it's been long enough we can say it, but we had just started, I think it was our second wind farm project. We are entirely green. There's like one or two people that have built the wind farm on the other jobs, but then most all of this new team is brand new. Like, we barely know that the windmill turns to make power. And we are at
our biggest this contract. This is where everybody can hear it.
I mean, it was, I want to say, 70 to 80 million by the end of the time. I could be wrong there, but we started with the substation, then we started with access roads, we started with getting into actual foundation construction. But we were so gung-ho on getting started, we had a trailer coming in for our office, we had equipment all over the place, building stuff, moving dirt, just in, out. And we had, I think every day there was a couple dozen rock trucks hauling 34 tons of gravel, some direction, somewhere. And one of these trucks comes around the turn, flying, just takes the turn too narrow and caught the ditch and rolled the truck, spread gravel all over this cornfield.
A truck and a trailer.
Yes, and a 34-ton trailer, barely missed the power line. Thank God the guy was alive. No injuries, no nothing, just cleanups. And it was funny because, you know, in the midst of all of this panic and chaos and people and lights and sirens and EMS, we have one manager that steps in along with me and a really good friend of mine who sat there and looked at each other and he says, we need to tell this at district meeting. And he's like, yeah, you know, safety, safety, safety. And we're like, no, this is the best performance factor of placing gravel in the history of company. And it's like, you know, that's things like that, that, you know, we laugh about, but it was some of that process driven, you know, making sure that things work like a clock. You know, there's always room for error. There's always something that's going to happen. And part of being a team on there is to make sure that we all hold each other accountable to making sure that we're doing the right thing.
Absolutely. Well, nothing like that's ever happened at SCA. But to move on to the topic of owning your own business. So you went from multi-billion-dollar company, a whole bunch of people, and very complex, seemingly, projects, I guess. And you went to owning your own business in, you know, landscaping business, which I think a lot of us probably fall into that category at some point. I certainly did. But where did that, why did you do that? And what did that look like? What time period?
Yeah, so I had worked with the company for 5 years. As I got to that 5 year period, I felt wear and tear on working with the wrong people, constantly being away from home. There was times like I was lucky if I was able to call my friend once a year to just say, hey, I was checking up on you, or get to see him once a year. I was on the road traveling all over the country. If I was not driving somewhere, I was flying somewhere or pulling a camper. I didn't have much family time. I was very isolated. I was in a very bad state of mind. And after, you know, just life kind of kicking you in the gut, you'd start asking yourself some questions. It was trying to envision something greater than where you're at now. And it's that personable accountability that comes down to of, this is my plan, this is how I'm going to do it, and that's it. There is no plan B. That last couple months of my career there, I filed for an LLC. I started making a plan to get some equipment. My first business was going to be a excavation company out in central Kansas. There's just a bunch of flat land, and there's always little contractors here and there. I figured it was a needed service. It was something I wanted to do. But the more I looked into it, it wasn't a great market, and it was going to be very hard to align that with my final vision. So after that fall, I took some time off. I went on a hunting trip and spent some time with family. I had started working with a excavation company just for a couple months, just get my feet on the ground after leaving the big company. And I put all of that planning into starting a landscaping and excavation business in Pennsylvania. And I just said, that's how it's going to work. That's what I want to do. Within the next year, I kind of humbled myself again, and I realized that it just wasn't working the way I wanted it to. There was pieces I was missing. I didn't like doing everything on my own. I liked the team roles. I liked the team environment. And I think that was a choice that I had made pretty quickly, that I wanted to shift to, just from handful of personal reasons and logic based, I think. It made sense to go and find somewhere to do what I enjoyed doing without having to do it all myself.
Absolutely. And to back up just for a second, you know, the reason you went to trying to own your own business, and obviously now you're kind of doing both, but a lot of the people that are on the travel side, so talking with an individual who fees with a really large general contracting firm in North Carolina, and he had mentioned that there's two kinds of people. There are the travelers, and then there are the non-travelers. And I think at some point, you know, people make a trade-off here and there. But as someone who did live the travel life, you went all over the country, you said, you know, flying or driving a whole bunch of places, and the pay is really, really good, which is most of the time comes with the package. But what are the really key things you sacrifice in the time? I'm sure at some point in your life, it is a great, you know, lifestyle to have. It's fun. But what are you sacrificing personally, professionally? Can you talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah. Traveling and making money is great. It's an adventure. You get to go see things. You get to go do things you wouldn't otherwise get to do in, say, a hometown, small town, or otherwise local to where you were from. It's very, I want to say, fast pace. You get in the habit of going to a place, hurry up, do it well, go to the next one. And after that process, you know, some people just enjoy it. Some people prefer not to do that. And I think when it comes to sacrifice, it's time. Being a traveling man, you are a company man, and you are basically on the clock all the time. If you're not at work, you're either going to work or coming home from work. No matter what the time frame is there, some days you get a couple days off, you get to fly home, you get to see your family for 3-4 days, drive or fly home back to the project. It becomes very cyclical. It becomes very, very, very abusive in some contexts because you are dedicating your entire life to your job and not to your family at home. My brother, in a very similar instance, is a foreman, and there's days where he's at work till late in the evening. He gets home and his daughter's asleep. The other day, his daughter was mad at him because she wasn't home to see her, or he was not home to see her come off the bus for the first day of school. That perspective really opened my eyes to, it's like, what do you want out of life and what are you willing to accept? If you're traveling and on the road and you get plenty of time with your family, great, then keep at it. But if you're constantly having to give and sacrifice and, like, you know, choose between going to work in the late evening or you get to go to a child's, you know, school event, which would you rather? And I think when you start asking yourself questions like that, it becomes very clear. Mine was my grandmother. Like, my grandmother was a very positive influence in my life, and I had to spend months away from her. I also had to spend months away from my grandfather, and I had to work the day that he passed away. That really sucked. That was a huge turning point before saying, okay, I need to take control of my life, and if I can't figure it out myself, then I need to start asking some questions. I need to come up with some different answers or find people who know the answers to put me in that position where I want to be in life.
Yeah, absolutely. And moving to, you know, the transition, you had your own business, and that really wasn't the answer either, at least with that, you know, specific model time period. And with SCA, it's kind of hard the way we've structured things, not really working Saturdays, not working Sundays. And, you know, you could call it the Chick-fil-A model, but even they work on Saturdays too. But in construction, we pull long days during the week, you know, Monday to Friday, even if it's raining, there's always things that are happening. But what would you say the biggest difference is? And I guess the value add, you know, we didn't pay as much as you would if you were on the road traveling 24/7, working 7 days a week. But with that change in mind, you know, what has your life been like? I mean, what have you benefited from? How have you been liking everything with that specific change? You're not traveling. You don't do overnight work. You don't do Saturday and Sunday work. And we try and, as difficult as this is, we do try and squeeze it between 7 and 5 as good as we can.
Mm-hmm. I get a really great perspective on this. I've been here 2 years. In the first year, I was a single man. I was living in a trailer. I had two dogs and nothing to do but hunt, fish, and enjoy. The second year I've been here, I've built a house. I have a family. I now have a homestead. I have a garden to take care of and chickens. which never thought was possible, but here we are. The giving up some of that travel, giving up being able to see a bunch of different places across the country, being able to make, you know, a couple percent more salary-wise was absolutely well worth it to be able to say, I can focus on my work a couple days a week. I have plenty of time to work on a side business. I also had plenty of time to work on building a home and having a relationship. So it afforded me, in what I lack financially, so much more value-wise because I could make a little extra money. I could also build something that was stable. I had a place to call home. It was work, no doubt, but it was probably about the same amount of hours I've had sitting behind a steering wheel driving across the country. That's one way to think about it.
And what's your perspective on, I guess, how this logo affects women directly? Because I also have an incredibly hot and attractive woman myself, and I also have chickens. And so how does this logo directly translate to attracting that kind of mate and lifestyle?
I think we're trying to get into a different market now, an untapped space. I mean, I think it edifies the family man, the guy who's willing to go to work, bust ass Monday through Friday, and then be able to say, you know, the weekend's for you type thing. It gives you a place and a position to have a family, to cater to a family, to be, for all intents and purposes, you know, a biblical man. Absolutely, rather than a traveling man or the company man, rather.
And in terms of longevity, so for the people that do want to have a family, and I say all that stuff facetiously, but I've got, you know, my first kid on the way, son, that'll be born in 6 weeks. Ish, but, and you have talked about you have now time for that family and something that really wasn't possible at all before. Can you speak to the people that when you did work on the traveling schedule? And again, I'm not trying to do this to beat a dead horse, but for the people that were in a relationship on the road, traveling all the time, what was that like? At least from the third party looking in, how were they handling that? What was it like? And what were,
I think there's a,
what are they trying to do,
coin flip? There was a handful of guys that I knew that I still know to this day that were, they were going to go out, they were going to hustle, they're going to do the job, they're going to go home, they're going to spend all their time with their spouse or significant other or their family for that matter. There was other guys that was in a very toxic type environment. I think, you know, in construction, much of construction can be deemed toxic. You get a lot of vulgarity, you get a lot of loudmouths, and you usually get a lot of the wrong crowd when it comes to partying and hanging out. And you'd have some guys that, you know, they'd go work all week and then they'd spend Monday through Friday at the bar. I happen to know that. I was in that position for a while. On the other hand, some of these other guys that would go hustle Monday through Friday and then go spend their weekends with their spouses, they often seemed like they were more successful. So from an outsider looking in or from the person who was, you know, kind of looking through a beer glass, it was like, that was not the life I saw long term. And if I did this or made these corrections and changes, I could be in the side where I get to spend quality time with somebody. I saw a previous coworker post the other day about that it wasn't the quantity of time that you spent with somebody, but the quality of time. Well, why not both? Why can't I have a bunch of good time with somebody rather than limited, you know, high output time? It's like, yeah, to get to see and do some cool things on a weekend, but why not do that more often? That seems like a better idea to me.
How you been to that? And it's been incredibly helpful for us and for what you have built, at least on the software side and just in generally operational help. I mean, you take our biggest clients from the very start to the very finish in terms of the estimating process, operational process, and general client management. But to talk about, I guess, your side business at the moment, I hesitate to call it a side business because it's getting, you know, pretty impressive at this point, is Terabid. And that's something that we use for all of our projects, our larger projects. You know, sometimes with the smaller stuff, we'll pencil it out. But it really is applicable to everything. And I know I have used a lot of different systems. You know, we were on 3.0.75 of our system when you first came on. And I was still spreadsheet related, and Terabid is, you know, a lot more sophisticated than that now. But can you explain, I guess, where did that all come from? And as you have had a lot of these different experiences, how have those all translated into what it's offering people now?
Yeah. Coming from that big corporate environment, even through college, I was always tasked with figuring out a system, a spreadsheet, do something and do it a little bit better than the other guy because, you know, it was very short-term based. But there was one company I worked with that I built an entire estimating program for just because of the way I understood the project. Working with, you know, Kiewit and starting new divisions, I had to understand different things. And I think every time I was in this new position, whether it be renewable energy or transmission line or power generation, I was doing things that I was like, why don't we have software for this? Like, this is a damn $20 billion company. We can't figure out how to make this a little better rather than a spreadsheet or a pen and paper or, you know, throwing stuff together. So it really clicked then. As we got to the end of working with that large company, I got to see their program from the field perspective, from the management perspective, the estimating perspective. It was all seamless. It all tied together. When I said that I wanted to start my own business and go into, say, landscaping excavation, I saw a problem. If I had to manage my clients, I had to have a CRM, I had to have a Jobber, or I could do it in QuickBooks, or I could do it on a spreadsheet, and there's a bunch of different ways to skin that cat. And then I have to schedule my work. Well, I could do it in this calendar, or I could do it this way, or I could do it on pen and paper, or a bunch of different ways to skin a cat. So there's all these different options available, but very few of them were cohesive and stuck together and all worked under the same platform. I couldn't manage one from my phone without having to have another one open on my computer. I couldn't do it all together. After I got to a point where the landscaping and excavation was like, this is not what I want to do, I saw a gap that contractors across the country struggled with a handful of things, whether it be estimating, whether it be time management or just overall project management, whether it had been job costing or the way that we were writing SOPs or processes. There was some problem that they had, and I had enough experience with it. I knew we could solve some of those. I think you and I had started working together with estimating. We did some takeoffs. That was the first piece of estimating in a new way based off the experience I had previously where we could really detail out costs. We could break out crews. We could understand man hour factors. We could understand durations and how they play against the overall cost of a project. In much of our small residential commercial work, as just contractors as a whole, we're not managing dollars. We're managing people. We're managing time. We're managing equipment. We're managing all these things. And our KPI that we typically look at is dollars. How much did we sell for? How much did we make? But how many hours did we spend? Did we go over budget on hours? Did we go over budget on equipment utilization? Did we use more equipment than we thought we were going to use people? Did we use more people than we thought we were going to use equipment? And what about material? How are we tracking it? All these little questions, you know, there's again, tons of different ways to skin that cat. And if that's the biggest problem somebody has, great. But they're still not all cohesive into the end result of after the project has been, and you know, from the stages of we have a lead, we have a proposal sent out, we have a one project, we have a project in progress, and we have one that's completed. Are we able to track the life cycle of that project dollar per dollar all the way through? Or do we wait till the very end to say, did we win or lose?
Yeah. And so for that was a lot, but to simplify this a little bit for the guy that, like, imagine to me, like 5 years ago, 6 years ago, whatever it was, where I've got two crews, you know, let's say where we're doing X dollars per month, but reasonably we have a couple crews. I'm doing all the sales, all the estimating. I'm accounting and marketing and operations and sales and every single hat. What does that do for me?
Gives you a place to put it all in one place. If you're going to bid a job and send out that estimate to the customer, it gives you a place to say that these are the resources you have available. This is how long it's going to take. And then put it on a schedule to say, this is when it's going to happen. This is what I need. It's all broken out in front of you where you don't have to go out and think, or, you know, you do have to think some, but you don't have to go back through and ruffle a bunch of papers up to try and find your notes on how many dollars per yard did I do this? Or how many cubic feet of material did I plan to have in here? Or whatever the case may be. It just gives you a very one-stop shop place to open up a project folder, see the estimate in detail, see what crews are there, see hours, see dollars, see material, give you a place to go out and order material through. We started this with a spreadsheet because that was the easiest way I knew how to put it together. Getting it to a place where we have software is like you have a whole project dashboard and it's living, breathing thing now, even if it's not an active project. And then the other piece is comparables, is you get to see what you estimate a project or complete a project through piece by piece. Is it unit-based? Is it hour-based? Is it quantity material? You get to compare it to the last one. Did we win on that one or do we lose? Where are we at with this one? It's becoming a essential tool that I've found in, my side business is also supporting contractors, is giving them a place to go out, bid a project, and 6 months later come back to and say, we're still on track. We don't have to go through and redo the estimate or try and figure out what our material costs were because it's all right there in front of us right from the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. And when can we expect something like that to be available?
So we have the completed prototype right now. And then in about 12 weeks, we're going to be doing a soft launch where you can have access to a web version. You can sign in, you can use the estimating dashboard and some basic CRM tools. And then over the course of the next couple of weeks after that, we'll be releasing different features and functions of the program that all tie together. So that first beta test is expected November 8th. So 7th is the Friday before the first week in November. That's right.
Very good. Well, we'll try and put a link in the description for y'all to access that. Or I know there's, I think you have a waiting list. And so we can throw that in there. But to cap this out, at least for today, one thing I like talking about is the stack of skill sets that somebody develops over time, where we have guys that are entry-level guys, we have guys like you, and the difference between hiring somebody like you or hiring a brand new guy that has no experience is there's not really one specific area that makes someone like you super valuable or someone that we're hiring like that super valuable. But it's really the stack of a lot of different things over the course of time, like estimating or like operations or like sales or like something like that. And could you speak to a little bit about the youngest guy or the new guy that's in construction? Let's say he's in working a factory job that he absolutely hates, or he's coming into high school and doesn't want to go to college. Maybe he does want to go to college or figure out the world. What advice can you give that guy, the brand newest guy, to have a developed career, make good decisions, have something that at the end of the day has substance, to where you mentioned you have the opportunity to have a family, have relationships, and finance as a whole, but how do you become valuable?
Yeah, I think the easiest way is find the most experienced guy that you can get around. If you're in a entry-level crew and you just have one guy that's really good at operating a piece of machinery, or your foreman's not one of the dickhead foremans that you can go up and ask questions to, go and continuously, basically just follow around, mimic every step that he does well, do the things that he would do or the way that he would do them, and be a shadow. Don't be afraid to follow somebody around. Don't be afraid to learn from somebody. Don't be afraid to ask questions, and don't be afraid to take risks. If it doesn't feel right, it's probably not right, and there's usually an opportunity in growth and, separating from a previous way of doing something. It's definitely a vision I have long term that I would love to stay here for a lifetime. The reality is there's always something new, and wherever that path may go is doing the absolute best that you can for the time being and give 150%. And if it doesn't always work out, you've probably gained enough skills that you can go somewhere else and do something. I actually had a dream about it the other night, a really weird, random dream about going and working with the company again, but there was parts of the dream that just didn't feel right. And it's like, that's why you left. It's a big leap. It's a leap of faith to say that you're going to walk away from something like that. It's a big leap of faith to say that you have enough faith and belief in yourself that you can do something, but who else is going to do it for you?
Amen to that. Well, I appreciate you being on here today. We'll have a link for the waiting list for TerraBid below. But if you guys have any questions, comments, or concerns, please feel free to reach out on socials or in the comments. Guess have a good day.